Mormon Sunday School is a production of the Olam Institute, which aims to nurture constructive approaches to religion and religious education. If you find this podcast helpful, please go to mormonsundayschool.org to sign up for a monthly subscription or to make a single donation. As the Olam Institute is a 501c3 nonprofit, all contributions are fully tax deductible. We also welcome you to join the conversation on Facebook or email me at jared@olaminstitute.org. Welcome, listeners, to Mormon Stories Sunday School. This will be our first episode of Engaging Gospel Doctrine. It will cover Lesson 25, Alma chapters 17 to 22. As you notice, we are starting right in the middle of the Book of Mormon. As I mentioned in the introductory podcast, I had to decide exactly how to approach the scriptures, where to start, and I decided that it was most important to stay with the normal gospel doctrine schedule. And this is so that all of you can listen to the podcast and incorporate whatever you want to of what you hear into either your lesson preparation or your comments. And I think everyone will be impressed. But the downside of this is that we didn't have the opportunity to start in the beginning of the Book of Mormon and discuss some of the framing and background issues, such as what is the nature of translation, you know, what are we looking at, which helps us adjust our expectations. We will be having podcasts about these issues. For now, I would refer you to Grant Hardy and Brant Gardner's podcast available on Mormon Stories, which both cover the Book of Mormon, and I will be posting links to those on the website. So I will now go over what we will be doing in this lesson. So Alma 17 to 22, little bit complex narrative there. And so first I'll introduce the content of what we are going to be covering. And then we will also look at some quite striking parallels between the story of Ammon and the story of Aaron. If you recall in the introductory podcast, I talked about reading strategies. And one of these is to look for patterns, repetition, emphases, and so forth. And there are some really interesting ones in the section that we're going to be covering today. And then I'm going to jump immediately into the take-home message of today's lesson, and then cover some other comments and discussion starters, basically going through the chapters, and we will see what we get through. And then after my portion of the lesson, we will have a classroom discussion with four other members of the class. And then we invite you all to weigh in on the blog and Facebook. So without further ado, I will get started. The goal of today's class is to help us better appreciate how the gospel can transform our nature. It could be called a tale of two kings. This story is a story of kings and queens, of violence and intrigue, and fainting. Lots of fainting. But ultimately, it's a story about transformation. At their core, these chapters are about changing our natures. We'll dig into the key stories first, then address the other points and details, as I said. Other important insights to look for in these chapters are what is the connection between our expectations and our interactions. And there are some good examples of how to engage with those of different backgrounds and beliefs. Taking a step back first, these chapters have a bit of a complex chronology, and Mormon is weaving several stories together. So here's how it breaks down. In Alma 17, verses 1 to 4, this is where Alma meets the sons of Mosiah after their respective missions. Based on the dating contained in our scriptures, these missions were about 91 to 77 BC. Now, when I say BC, before Christ, it's important to be aware that the way time was reckoned in the Book of Mormon does not seem to correspond exactly to the way that we reckon time. Grant Hardy brings this up in his Reader's Edition of the Book of Mormon, and so he prefers to calculate time by years before the sign of Christ's appearance is given. For convenience, I'm going to stay with the annotations in the LDS version of the scriptures, but just keep in mind it is not precise, not to get too hung up on it. It helps mostly with relative dating. So we begin after the long missions of both Alma and the sons of Mosiah, and then Mormon backs up and starts to introduce the beginning of the Sons of Mosiah's mission. So in chapter 17, verses 5 to 17, we're in at about 90 BC or so. The first large block is chapter 17, verse 18 to 19:36. And this is the main story where Ammon teaches Lamoni and his people. Then in chapter 20, Ammon and Lamoni meet Lamoni's father on their way to rescue Ammon's brothers and friends. And then Mormon backs up again and goes to the beginning of the other mission with Aaron, Molokai, and their companions. And they begin their missions with no success. And as we'll see, we don't know how long many days was that they were in prison, but it does seem toward the beginning of the 14 years. So on the bottom of your scriptures there, it just says somewhere between 91 to 77 BC. Chapter 21, verses 18 to 23 is Mormon's summary conclusion of Ammon and Lamoni. And then once again, we switch. It's kind of like a director switching scenes. And in chapter 22, verses 1 to 26, Ammon is teaching Lamoni's father. And then to finish it off, verses 27 to 35 of chapter 22, we have a digression about geography. The most important story is the story of Ammon and Lamoni. And so this begins in chapter 17. And I want to look at the parallels between this story and the story of Aaron before we look at each in detail. So I've included the notes on the webpage so you can follow along if you want. I invite you all to go to mormonsundayschool.org and you can find all the information there. So you have the story of Ammon in 17 to 19, and then Aaron in the beginning of chapter 22. In both, there's a king, a queen, the offer of service, servants, the people, emotions, what is taught, and then the result. Pay attention to these parallels. So first, I'll say Ammon and then Aaron. In Ammon's narrative, the discussion with Lamoni is a dialogue. In Aaron's, Lamoni's father shows extraordinary preemptive faith. He says, I will believe whatever you say, even before hearing it. Then the queen is a major figure in both stories. In Ammon's story, the wife of Lamoni shows exemplary faithfulness. But Lamoni's father, his wife, manifests anger, fear, and hard-heartedness. Both Ammon and Aaron volunteer to give service to their kings. Ammon wins over the king this way, and with Aaron, the opportunity is refused. It seems that Aaron was trying to follow his brother's example here. The servants in Ammon's story are engaged. They're part of the conversion process. They testify to the king. They also fall to the earth and have a conversion experience. With Aaron's stories, they're passive. They're on the sidelines. Then there's the wider audience, the people present. With the story of Ammon, there's a key convert, Abish, whom we'll talk about more in depth, but still general contention and misunderstanding. But the result is that everyone is converted, as we'll discuss in a moment. With Aaron's story, there's fear that there should be contention. Again, there are these key words that bind the two narratives, and then murmuring. In Ammon's story, as far as emotions go, Lamoni is astonished. It shows that multiple times, and he faints. In chapter 18, verse 42, it says that he fell unto the earth as if he were dead. With Lamoni's father, he's troubled, and then he faints. And the difference in wording is very interesting here. Instead of it just saying he fell to earth as if he were dead, it says he was struck as if he were dead. So interesting little bit of emphasis. There are very strong parallels between what is taught by Ammon and then by Aaron. Perhaps they were using the ancient version of the missionary discussions. I'm kidding. So with the teaching, it starts talking about the nature of God. Ammon rewords it as, do you know what the Great Spirit is? They talk about the heavens and the earth, the Holy Spirit, creation of the world, Adam. Interestingly, it says Ammon told Lamoni, 1836, what's in the scriptures. He recounts the stories of the prophets down to Lehi, as well as the history of the Lehites. It says, he expounded unto them all the records and scriptures from the time that Lehi left Jerusalem down to the present time. Note it says, he expounded the plan of redemption prepared from the foundation of the world, the coming of Christ, and all the works of the Lord. Now, with Aaron's conversation, Aaron asks if he believes in God, and the king is the one who asks if it's the Great Spirit. Aaron talks about the heavens and earth, and he reads the scriptures unto the king in 22:12. I don't know if we should assume that Ammon has a greater mastery of the scriptures because it says he expounded while Aaron reads, but Aaron also talks about the creation of Adam. He says that man was created after God's image, the commandments, the transgression and fall, human's carnal state, the plan of redemption, which was prepared from the foundation of the world. In both texts, it has those key words. The plan of redemption is prepared from the foundation of the world, and it ultimately talks about the atonement and resurrection. So the result with Ammon is that the king cries for mercy for himself and his people and is overcome. And his prayer is, O Lord, have mercy, according to thy abundant mercy, which thou hast had upon the people of Nephi, have upon me and upon my people. So the focus is on mercy. And then the queen sends for Ammon. She responds in faith. She and her servants are overcome. There's the story of Abish. And then the people are converted. With Aaron's story, the king prays to know God. He says, make thyself known unto me, and I will give away all my sins to know thee, and that I may be raised from the dead and saved at the last day. There's an interesting emphasis in the prayers. We'll go into them more in detail later. But with Lamoni is crying for mercy, both for himself and his people. There's a lot of unity there. With Lamoni's father, it seems that he's focused more on himself. There's a real concern for the end of the world and the resurrection. So what happens after Lamoni's father's prayer? His wife, instead of showing the trust and faithfulness of Lamoni's wife, Lamoni's father's wife tries repeatedly to get Aaron killed. And interestingly, at the end, it doesn't say the people are converted. It says they were pacified. And also, if we read closely, we will notice that it doesn't say anything about the queen. So we don't know whether she was pacified or not. So that is a broad overview of the parallels between these two texts. I'd like to now go more in depth with each of these stories and go carefully through different elements of the central narratives and draw from them what we can. Okay, let's start some careful reading. I want to start with the story of Ammon and Lamoni. And another thing that I wanted to point out is how much humor there is in these stories. I think that we view the scriptures justifiably as sacred, but we miss a lot of the human elements of the scriptures when we do. And there's some good moments, so watch out for those. So it says that Ammon is the chief among the missionaries, and he goes into the land of Ishmael. This is part of what's called the land of their first inheritance. So we're talking about wherever the Lehites first landed. The Lamanites are right there because the Nephites moved on more toward the center of the land. So Ammon enters the land, and he's taken and bound captive, where they could either be slain or imprisoned. So Lamoni is talking to, he's a descendant of Ishmael, and he's talking to Ammon. And he asks Ammon if it's his desire to dwell in the land among the Lamanites. And Ammon has a great witty answer. He says, yea, I desire to dwell among this people for a time, and perhaps until the day I die. I wouldn't be surprised if he were thinking, and that might be today. Lamoni's really happy with this. And so he says, hey, you know, I would like to give you some status in this culture. Do you want to marry one of my daughters? And Ammon says, no thanks. Now, it'd be really dangerous in most cultures to turn down an offer of marriage into the royal family, but Ammon survives that. And he says, I will be your servant, though. And we know this story very well. So Ammon defends the king's flocks. Interestingly, it never says what animals they are herding exactly. It says they're watering them, there's pasture, so who knows what animal they were. So the backstory is that these other Lamanites are stealing the flocks of the king, and previous servants to whom this has happened have been killed. And sure enough, the troublemakers come, they steal the flocks, and Ammon gets excited about it, and he says, this is a great opportunity to win the hearts of my fellow servants, that I may lead them to believe in my words. This is 17:29. And this is a good life application moment, that people are willing to listen to us as we serve them and help them and be where they are. So we have this great story from the Book of Mormon where the robbers try to fight Ammon and he starts slinging stones at them and they die. And then, of course, he starts chopping off their arms. And the leader he kills with a sword. And it says, with a bit of understatement, they were not a few. So the servants, they had regathered their flocks. The servants go and the servants bring in all the arms that had been cut off by Ammon. Now, it's an interesting, we could think about the ethics of this, but we will move on for now. One of my favorite verses is in 18, verses 8 and 9. It says, "And it came to pass that King Lamoni inquired of his servants, saying, where is this man that has such great power? And they said unto him, behold, he is feeding thy horses." I don't think the horses are the flocks because they're described differently. Now, I want to make one point about horses. Critics of the Book of Mormon have commented that there weren't horses during this time, and so that proves that there's a problem with the Book of Mormon there. But I will just say now that there's a key translation issue. Obviously, the golden plates wouldn't say horses, so it's hard to say what exactly animal it was talking about. But that's a side topic. We're not going to get into it right now. Again, there are many lessons in these chapters. The king is wondering, after he sees these arms, who Ammon is. And the servants say, we don't know what he is. We don't know whether he's the Great Spirit or a human, but we know he's a friend to the king. And I just want to emphasize this in our lives. Is there anything more important than people knowing that we are their friend? More important than what we have to say or differences of opinion? There has to be that foundation of friendship. There's the great analogy of having an emotional bank account and always making sure that you have enough in the bank account to make withdrawals if you need to discuss difficult issues or disagree and so forth. But Ammon had demonstrated that he was on the king's side, that he was a friend of the king. So Ammon, after he's done with his chores, he made ready the horses and the chariots, which again, people have said it's an anachronism, but it's key to remember that the Book of Mormon, as we have it, is a 19th century document, whatever sources or origin it has. But again, I want to focus on the main story. So this, again, has a little bit of humor here. King Lamoni, after Ammon says, now what do you want me to do? The king just sits dumbstruck for an entire hour, and Ammon needs to pull out his mind-reading skills. He perceives the thoughts of the king, and he says, oh, you know, are you speechless because of what I did? And he says, I am a man, and I am thy servant. Therefore, whatsoever thou desirest, which is right, that will I do. This is exemplary teaching right now. Ammon is amazing at teaching. He listens. He's patient. He waits. He's prepared the king, and he's meeting the king where he is. So the king is marveling, and here's another bit of humor. In verse 18, it says, he beheld that Ammon could discern his thoughts, but notwithstanding this, so even though he thought Ammon was a mind reader, King Lamoni did open his mouth and said, who art thou? Art thou the great spirit who knows all things? And Ammon says, I am not. There's an interesting parallelism where Ammon says in verse 17, whatsoever thou desirest, which is right, that will I do. And then King Lamoni says, whatsoever thou desirest of me, I will grant unto thee. So now we get into the core of Ammon's teaching. He says, do you believe that there's a God? And Lamoni says, I don't know what you mean. So Ammon rephrases, do you believe there's a great spirit? Ammon says, this is God. Do you believe that God created the heaven and the earth? Lamoni says, yes, I believe that the great spirit created the earth, but I don't know what you mean by heaven. Ammon says, the heaven is where God and the angels dwell. King Lamoni said, is it above the earth? Which I think a lot of children we know would ask something similar. But this does shed some insight into the worldview. This Mesopotamians believed the same thing, where there was a realm literally above the earth, and the stars were lights shining through that realm, then the earth and the area below the earth. King Lamoni says, I believe what you're saying. Are you sent from God? And Ammon is extremely clear. He says, I'm a man, because he already knows that King Lamoni is going to be thinking that he's divine. So he makes sure that there cannot be misunderstanding. And then he starts teaching his central message. It's interesting to see that Lamoni and Ammon are having this back and forth dialogue. together. And so Ammon talks about the creation of Adam, holy scriptures, prophets, and he focuses on the plan of redemption, this is in verse 39, which is prepared from the foundation of the world, and he also made known unto them concerning the coming of Christ, and all the works of the Lord did he make known unto them. Now what's the result? The king believes all his words, and he prays, saying, O Lord, have mercy according to thy abundant mercy which thou hast had upon the people of Nephi, have upon me and my people. And then he passes out. The servants take his body, carries him to his wife, and he lays there for 2 days and 2 nights, and his wife and sons and daughters mourn after him, thinking he's dead. Now they're about to put him in the tomb, and the queen sends to Ammon. And here's another bit of a humorous point. The queen says, the servants of my husband have said, you're a prophet of God, you have a lot of power. Please see my husband, help my husband. You know, some people say he's not dead. Some people say he is dead and he stinks. And then there's this great phrase, as for myself, to me, he doth not stink. In an earlier version of my scriptures, I said, you know, this is true love. And note how detailed verses 6 through 7 are of chapter 19. It says, now Ammon, this is what Ammon desired. He knew that King Lamoni was under the power of God. He knew the dark veil of unbelief was being cast away from his mind, and the light which did light up his mind, which was the light of the glory of God, which was the marvelous light of his goodness. Yea, this light had infused such joy into his soul, the cloud of darkness having been dispelled, and the light of everlasting life was lit in his soul. Yea, he knew that this had overcome his natural frame, and he was carried away in God. Now, notice the light and the darkness imagery of these verses. And Ammon likely knows from personal experience what the king is going through. His own story is told in Mosiah 27. So there's this very strong light and darkness imagery. And Ammon says, he is not dead, but sleepeth in God, and on the morrow he shall rise again. This not dead, but sleepeth has New Testament allusions, including Jairus, his daughter, in Mark 5:39. And Ammon says, believest thou this? And she said unto him, I have no witness save thy word and the word of our servants. Nevertheless, I believe that it shall be according as thou hast said. And Ammon said unto her, blessed art thou because of thy exceeding faith. I say unto thee, woman, there has not been such great faith among all the people of the Nephites. So this also has allusions in Luke 7:9 to the healing of the centurion's servant. But again, Lamoni's wife is an example of incredible faith and love. In verse 11, it says she watches over the bed of her husband from that time until the time that Ammon says she shall rise. And so Lamoni gets up and he talks about his experience in 13. He says, as sure as thou livest, behold, I have seen my Redeemer. He shall come forth and be born of a woman, and he shall redeem all mankind who believe in his name. So then he has another spiritual experience. The queen sinks down with him. She's overpowered by the Spirit. Ammon is overpowered by the Spirit. The servants are overpowered by the Spirit, and so everyone falls to the ground, and it's this really great, overwhelming spirit fest. And this is where a key character is introduced, Abish. In 19:16, it says, everyone falls to earth, save it were one of the Lamanitish women, whose name was Abish. She, having been converted unto the Lord for many years on account of a remarkable vision of her father. We can discuss this later, but I want to point out that there are only 6 women named in the entire Book of Mormon, 3 from the Bible and 3 unique. Eve, Mary, and Sarah are named biblical figures, and then Sariah, Abish, and Isabel are named. There are lots of other women characters, but only 3 have names apart from the biblical ones, so something to think about there. So the story about Abish, it's a brief reference to a fuller story, and here is where we get to expectations and the way we interact with other people. So Abish is really excited. She wants to summon everyone, and it says in verse 17, supposing that this opportunity by making known unto the people what had happened among them, that by beholding the scene it would cause them to believe in the power of God. Therefore she ran from house to house, making it known unto the people. Here's another bit of humor. When the people arrive, it says everyone is laying there as though they were dead, and they also saw Ammon, and behold, he was a Nephite. So they began to murmur. The people who Ammon, you know, the brother of the leader that Ammon killed was there, and there's a lot of contention. So Abish is really, really sad, her actions did not have the outcome that she intended. And so again, I think this is a good application point here that we can be careful interacting with others and try to understand how they'll respond. Here's an interesting discussion point. In verse 22, the brother of the leader who's slain by the sword of Ammon, he's about to kill Ammon. And as he's about to kill Ammon, bam, he gets struck dead by God. So that's an interesting question about miracles and what can God do then. And I certainly wish that God would strike dead all of those who are about to kill and abuse and do terrible, terrible things. So that's a theological point. And of course, that contradicts many, many other aspects in scripture where, you know, you have the weeping God who watches the suffering of humans and there's the plan of redemption and agency and so forth, instead of this immediate miraculous intercession that saves lives. So that could be a discussion point. But Mormon says, you know, we see that Ammon could not be slain because he promised that I will spare him. So let's look at the result with what happens. So Abish is really sad that there's so much contention. She sees all this. She starts to cry. She takes the queen. I really like how she grabs the queen's hand and not the king's. She grabs the queen's hand, and then the queen starts prophesying. We have very strong female figures in these chapters. In fact, as we'll discuss, Danielle Mooney, who's part of the class discussion, we were going to start with the next lesson, but she said, no, we have to start with this one because it has such strong female characters. And there are few enough female characters in scripture that I think that we need to emphasize every single one. So the queen gets up. She says, oh, blessed Jesus, who has saved me from an awful hell. Oh, blessed God, have mercy on this people. It's parallelism. We don't know if she's calling Jesus God or whether she's praying both to Jesus and Heavenly Father. The portrayal of God in the Book of Mormon is a separate topic, very worthy of discussion. She experiences the gift of tongues. And in verse 30, it says she speaks many words which are not understood. And it says in verse 31, as many as heard Lamoni's words believed and were converted unto the Lord, but there were many among them who would not hear his words. So maybe by hear it means something more like listen to. Though everyone who listened was converted, but those who would not listen were not converted. They left. And this is just a note to pay very close attention to what words are selected, what words aren't selected. There's a lot that we can get from this detail. Now, here is the take-home message of today's class. Verses 33 to 36, this is the core. It says, and it came to pass that when Ammon arose, he also administered unto them, and also did the servants of Lamoni, for they did all declare unto the people the selfsame thing, that their hearts had been changed, that they had no more desire to do evil. And I'd like to pick this up in the discussion, and it's what I want to focus on more than anything. This is also a key theme multiple other places in the scripture. It's King Benjamin's speech, Mosiah 5. It's this idea of what can we do to change our natures so we don't even desire to do evil, to do selfish and hurtful things to others. So I would like to discuss that in the discussion portion of the class. In the interest of time, I'm going to focus right on the discussion between Aaron and Lamoni's father. There's lots to cover here, Ammon's interactions with Lamoni's father, but let's get to Aaron talking to Lamoni's father after Aaron and his brethren have been released from prison and suffered many things. So Aaron is talking to Lamoni's dad, and he says, this is in chapter 22, Aaron says, O king, if thou wilt spare our lives, we will be thy servants. So he's trying to take a card from Ammon's deck. This is 22 verse 3. And the king said, ah, never mind that. I just want to talk to you. You know, arise. I don't want you to be my servants, but please teach me. I have been troubled because of the generosity of your brother Ammon. If you remember in verse 20, Ammon runs into Lamoni's father. Lamoni's father is going to kill Lamoni. Ammon bests him with the sword because he's buff and strong like that. And Lamoni says, save my life. I'll give you whatever you want. And all Ammon wants is, he says, you know, grant authority to your son. Let me release my brethren from prison. And so he wants nothing for himself. So this leads to the teaching opportunity between Aaron and Lamoni's father. And Lamoni's dad quotes something that Ammon said that we don't have a record of. He says, If you will repent, you shall be saved. And if you will not repent, you shall be cast off at the last day. And this frames the rest of the discussion. So again, lots of parallels. Aaron says, believest thou that there's a God? And the king says, the Amalekites say there's a God, and I let them build their sanctuaries. But now we get into this amazing preemptive faith. In verse 7, Lamoni's father says, if you say there's a God, I'll believe. Aaron says, there is a God. The king asks, is God that great spirit? Aaron says, yes, do you believe this? And this is really extraordinary. We can see all the preparation that led to Lamoni's father being so ready. He says, I believe the great spirit created all things. I want you to teach me. I want you to tell me. I will believe everything you say. So Lamoni's father's heart is so prepared that he says, you tell me it. I will believe it. So Aaron reads the scriptures. I've already covered what he talks about. And he sets out the plan of redemption. So I love the reaction of Lamoni's father. And once again, this is another take-home point that I really want to focus on. In 22:15, Lamoni's father says to Aaron, what shall I do that I may have this eternal life of which thou hast spoken? What shall I do that I may be born of God, having this wicked spirit rooted out of my breast, and receive his spirit, that I may be filled with joy, that I may not be cast off at the last day? Behold, said he, I will give up all that I possess. I will forsake my kingdom, that I may receive this great joy. Now, one irony here that is really fun, if you look at the parallels between the different parts of the Book of Mormon, is who is Lamoni's dad talking to? He is talking to a prince who did give up his kingdom to be saved. So that's a nice bit of parallelism there. But that's not the answer. And again, we could talk about what's presupposed about human nature here with this whole like wicked spirit idea. But the focus is transformation. Aaron says, if you desire this thing and you'll bow down before God, repent of your sins, call on his name in faith, believe that you shall receive, then you shall receive hope. And I love this prayer. I love the prayer of Lamoni's dad. He says, O God, Aaron hath told me that there is a God, and if there's a God, and thou art God, will you make yourself known to me? And now he gets it. He doesn't say, I'll give up my kingdom. He says, I will give away all my sins to know you, that I may be raised from the dead, saved at the last day. So there's parallelism here. He goes from, I'll give up everything. I'll give up what I possess to know you. And then he hits on what exactly we do need to give up in order to know God. He says, I will give up all my sins. I will give up all my shortcomings. I will give up everything that causes me to fall short, that prevents me from being in the presence of God. And then he is struck as if it were dead. And the rest of the story, I've already gone over. The queen doesn't get it. She tries to get the servants to kill Aaron, and they're like, we're not gonna kill Aaron. We saw this whole thing, so she starts being afraid. Then she calls everyone else and says, someone kill this Nephite, but no one will do it. And Aaron saw the determination of the queen, hardness of the hearts of the people. He fears there'll be contention. So he lifts the king to earth. He says, stand up. The king gets up and begins to minister them. His household is converted. The people are pacified. It doesn't say what the queen did. And that is the end of that story. Now, there are many, many little points, and I'll bring up as many of them as I can during the discussion. But what I want us to take home during this lesson and discuss and ponder on is, how are we converted? How are we changed? How are we transformed to have a Christ-like nature? And also, there are just powerful ideas about teaching and preparation. And so once again, I'd say a really important take-home from these chapters is, in our lives, in our relationships, how can we prove ourselves friends, prove ourselves loving, know people well enough so that we can guess how they'll respond to what we have to say? So we'll maximize the chance that they'll hear our words and they also will experience an existence with godlike attributes. So that's the end of the lesson, and the remainder will be a classroom discussion. We will incorporate both the input of our class members who will participate, and we will also be bringing up select comments and questions from those that we've heard from online. So now we are moving into the class discussion part of the lesson. And I would like to welcome our four class members this week. We have Mike, Gwen, Paul, and Danielle. And why don't each of you introduce who you are and where you're from before we get into the conversation?
This is Mike. I live in Southern Oregon, down by Ashland, Oregon. I'm the older brother to Paul, who's also on the podcast, and just kind of happy to be here.
Hi, this is Gwen. I'm in Indianapolis. I'm not a Hoosier. I don't like it that much here, but maybe someday. And that's all.
Hi, I'm Paul. I'm the little brother to Mike, and I'm here in Provo, Utah, and my favorite color is blue. Just kidding.
I'm Danielle. I am in Boston, and I moved out here from Minnesota. I love the East Coast, but I do miss the Midwest quite a lot, and I am excited to join this class.
Well, I really appreciate you all participating in our first lesson. There's a little bit of backstory, not to put Danielle too on the spot, but as I mentioned during the lesson, we were going to start with lesson 26. And in our Facebook discussion, Danielle said, we cannot neglect this lesson that has two of the best female characters in the Book of Mormon. So that's something to look forward to. What I'd like to do is, why don't each of you share what struck you the most in the reading or lesson? And then we'll go around once and open up the discussion from there.
All right. I guess I'm going first then. So you touched on this a little bit, Jared, and it was this idea, these parallel narratives that you find within this lesson with Ammon and King Lamoni and then Aaron and King Lamoni's father. What kind of strikes me is that when I look at Mormon as a editor to the large plates, he seems to be particularly concerned with the historicity of things, that things have a certain date when they occurred, but he seems to use these historical events to weave a theological narrative, what he wants the reader to get out of it. And sometimes he'll keep the important historical things, such as in the lesson before this, where the Ammonites get slaughtered, the people, the city of Noah get destroyed, and then Mormon kind of goes, see, this is what happens when you're good. When you're bad, you get destroyed, and when you're good, you prosper. But he kind of all suddenly forgets about the people of Noah. So he includes them in the historical narrative, but because they don't fulfill what he's trying to teach theologically, he kind of drops them from it. And here we see with the parallel narratives with Ammon and then his brother Aaron, is you find that these parallel narratives, like you pointed out, and it seems to me that Mormon does that because there are certain things that he deliberately wants people to find, that he deliberately selects things to shape his narrative, to show that, you know, working out God's will and certain kinds of events are likely to recur again. And that's it. One thing, just kind of as a side note, I think would be interesting, and I didn't have a chance to do this, would be to form two different tables. And I did a similar thing with my priests last year around Easter, where we went through the four Gospels, and we had four different tables, one corresponding to each of the Gospel narratives of the resurrection. And we went through each one, and we read them in a parallel fashion instead of linear. And we picked out all the discrepancies in there and also the commonalities. And by doing so, I found that these 16 to 18-year-old boys were able to really pull out something from there and pull out what the importance was in the narratives that the four Gospel authors pointed out. And I think it'd be a fun exercise to do with this lesson, doing the same thing with Ammon and then with Aaron's stories and the conversion stories of these two Lamanite kings.
Yeah, that's a great comment. I will be posting my lesson notes, and I did make that table. And I was struck as I was preparing that the opposites, you know, how they're the parallels, but in so many ways, there are differing opinions. The response of the queen was just striking how different it was. And I agree with you that there is a tremendous amount, and I think this is one of the great points Grant Hardy makes, is there is a really impressive amount of sophistication in the Book of Mormon. And that's very clear with these parallel narratives and so forth.
Yeah, when I read the scriptures, there's two things I usually try to do. The first is pay attention to the organization. So you're looking at these two sides, these parallels, but I can't connect to the scriptures that way. But through listening to the lesson, I was able to sort through some things that I've always kind of got hung up with on these chapters. So it was really great. So I think that's awesome that you guys brought that up right at the get-go. But the second thing I try to do, of course, is liken the scriptures unto me. And so it gets down at a personal level to me really quickly with what am I supposed to be learning from this, and what am I portraying in King Lamoni's father, and it just speaks to me at this really deep level. And in reading through it this time, Jared, when you mentioned it's all about this transformation, and it brings that is that love. The love that we feel is the power of God. And I think it's interesting because sometimes I think we, I don't want to say discount it, but we call it something else. We hear it called the priesthood, I think, a lot. But I think the power of God is love, and it's all over in these chapters. We're talking about the friendships between Ammon and Lamoni, and then what happens through King Lamoni's father when he's converted through the Spirit, and what he's willing to give because of the love that he feels from God. It just is amazing. I love it.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I want to pick that up later.
The one thing that stood out for me was, of course, the story of Abish and her conversion story, and the fact that she, was it a vision of her father, or did she have this vision? The way it's kind of worded, it's kind of funny. It says vision of her father or whatever. Anyway, I imagine this person that's all alone amongst the Lamanites and her wanting to share this joy that she has, that she found, and she really can't say anything to anybody, because I imagine being with the Lamanites, having some sort of religion pertaining to the Nephites, she would have been killed or something other that's drastic. So I imagine through her actions that she somehow prepared the hearts of these people. And so when Ammon came, they were better responsive to when Aaron and his brothers, wherever they went, they didn't have an Abish there. There's no preparatory work. There's no seeds planted for them. And so this Abish person is really, I think, vital in the conversion story of the people. I imagine they softened up because she was a good person and she was a good example for the rest of the people. And I kind of lack in that, kind of in an opposite of missionary work. As someone that's not so orthodox in the church, sometimes you feel like you can't say anything too crazy or too unorthodox, or as you kind of get the look from everyone else. And so it's important, I think, in the story, how I apply Abish is to be a good example, to build up credibility within your group, your sphere of influence, and so that you can maybe point out some difficult issues sometimes when they come up in lessons. And so you have that cred with your ward members, as this person is a good person, he's a good example.
It is really interesting to see the differences in impact. At the same time, Abish, she has this amazing influence. And yet, as I commented in the lesson, it's a little bit of a cautionary tale. Do you know what I mean, Paul? Because she says in 1917, supposing that this would be great and, you know, people would immediately understand what it was. And she's so excited for this opportunity to share her beliefs. And then it just makes everyone start having contention. And she ends up in tears. But I mean, it has a happy ending, but I really think it also, it's kind of both and, do you know what I mean? Where, yes, we can prepare people with our actions, but we also need to think through very carefully how people are going to respond when we share things that might be challenging. So she's a really important character.
Going off of that, what really draws me to this lesson is the stories of the powerful women, including Abish and the queen that she serves. Partly because there are so few women in the Book of Mormon who play a role of any significance in the stories, but also because, separate from that, these two women are very spiritually strong. Whether it was a vision of her own that Abish believed on, or a vision of her father's that she believed on, it was a conversion that demonstrated great faith for her to come to that place in the culture and among the people that she grew up amongst, and then to hold that close to her heart for all the years that she lived and worked among her people and serving in the royal house, until one day this opportunity arises for her to declare her faith as well. So when Abish brings all the people to see the fallen members of the court, problems erupt. But what I love is that the contention is soothed when the queen awakes, when Abish takes her hand, and it's the queen's testimony that calms the contention in the room. And so the power of her testimony, the power of the declaration she makes in her faith in the blessed Jesus and in blessed God, who she has learned it is through them that she's saved, and it's her testimony of that that calms the crowd and the building contention. And so I think that necessarily had to be quite a powerful declaration for her to make, both in an oratorical sense, but also in the spiritual energy that she was communicating to them. To calm a mob is quite a feat.
Yeah, and I want to dig in. I love everything you said, and this is very much a high point from a woman's perspective. Not that I can speak to that. But as far as a close reading, it's really impressive how active and how the women are main characters. Like, they're actually, they're main characters in these stories. And so you just don't get that enough. You know, you don't get these women being main characters. But if you look, Abish is the one who is gathering the people. She's going out. She is responding. She's reacting to this. And then I really love, as you said, Danielle, that she first raises the queen. You know, and it's really beautiful. It's woman to woman. You know, she raises the queen. The queen is the one who prophesies. You know, she prophesies, she prays, she speaks in tongue. And only then does the queen raise the king. I think it is a wonderful reversal. Supplement to the normal narrative where far too often it's just male-centered. And this is an opportunity that we get for the female perspective a bit more. I would like to keep with the queen and hear your thoughts on the narrative in chapter 19, where everyone is thinking that Lamona is dead, and the queen's initiative and her response and what Ammon has to say about her. Are you laughing about the stinkiness?
Yeah, it just cracked me up, man.
No, it is funny to imagine the debate among the servants and the royal household about whether or not he smells bad. They can't decide.
Or maybe back then it was more, now what's the source of the bad smell? Like, is that dead people bad smell? Or is that just like normal bad smell?
That whole line is kind of bizarre because it, like, why is it even there, right? Does it add anything to the narrative? It's just kind of seems to me it comes out of left field, and that maybe in particular that's why it's really funny. I mean, I laugh when I read it, and all my brothers laugh too. So.
Isn't it an anchor to the New Testament though? Because it seems like through just to bring in, as far as a conversion perspective, it brings in a familiar element from a book that they may already know. Because isn't the New Testament filled with them talking about, you know, Lazarus and all these people that are dying that Jesus raised from the dead, and are they stinking yet? Is that not an issue? Is that something I've made up in my head?
No, it's in the Lazarus story, you're right. And there are other striking parallels, as I said in the lesson. There are quite a few parallels. I mean, he is not dead, but sleepeth, you know, definitely evokes the stories of Jesus.
I don't think so much about the stinking as it's about drawing that this is another testament of Jesus Christ. So we're going to bring the parallels are going to be found in both books. And I've always really appreciated that.
And even though it's funny, I think it's kind of a touching relationship note, you know, where the queen's like, this is my husband and I know him and people are debating, but I know him and he's not dead. You know, he doesn't stink to me. But I think it's a touching testament with that relationship. And I really love her response when Ammon asks her if she believes. Did you want to make a comment about that, Danielle?
Sure. So what she says is, I have had no witness save thy word and the word of our servants. Nevertheless, I believe that it shall be according as thou hast said. And Ammon blesses her because of this demonstration of her faith and says that it's a faith not even seen among all the people of the Nephites. And I think the whole experience of her seeking out, I mean, the same way Abish takes it upon herself to act at an opportunity to share the gospel and to draw in all the people outside of the palace. And so she goes and acts. Her husband is lying unconscious, apparently dead, and she takes it upon herself to seek out Ammon and to seek his opinion, which is in and of itself an act of faith, and then believes what he tells her. So she's like very clearly strong spiritual figure in this story. And I really also like that when he arises, it's the third day, which I think is a very beautiful parallel to Christ.
Yeah, I like that. She not only expresses her faith in words, she expresses it in action because she watches over the bed, you know, all night until he wakes up.
Yes.
Well, good. I definitely wanted to highlight the strong women in this story. Other thoughts about this key issue of transformation and what it takes for us to change? At the core of these parallels are these conversion narratives. So I wanted to hear any thoughts you have on those before we move to general questions and comments.
I like that you brought that up because I came in at church today. We were on this lesson and I came in late, and I could tell that the whole focus of the lesson up until then was the missionary efforts of Ammon and Aaron. And I ran out of time before I could raise my hand and point out exactly what you're bringing up is the story isn't that. It's the transformation that comes to these people, right? These Lamanites that supposedly just hate the Nephites. and have all these traditions about them, and that they're transformed. And that when each one wakes up, the first thing they say when they wake up is they bear this testimony of the Son of God, of Jesus Christ. That's the first thing that comes out of their mouths. And I like that a lot. It's a good Christ-centered message, gospel message.
You have the queen who obviously knows her husband. She loves him. He's not dead yet. She's speaking for him. She knows his heart, which also is Ammon. When the king brings in Ammon to say, hey, can you explain what's going on? And he interprets everything that the king had said. And he says, it's because of the spirit. And I thought, it's because he loves you. He already knows you. And there's already this connection and this kinship between these people, but it's just happened. In the story, it happens so quickly. We don't really know how much time has passed. But when there's somebody else to connect and kind of guide you through your transformation or through your transition of sorts, it just opens your heart up to understand what love is.
That's really beautiful.
Another thing I think adds another dimension, I talked a little bit about this in the lesson with the fact that Lamoni's father is saying, I will give up my kingdom to the heir of the throne. Aaron kind of gets the short shrift, right? Mormon spends a lot more time talking about Ammon, says, oh yeah, Ammon's in charge. But Aaron, as I understood it, he was the heir to the throne. He was the oldest son. And I really love that parallelism. And I'm looking in Mosiah 28 right now, where the background to these amazing missionary efforts and the conversion efforts are the conversion of the sons of Mosiah themselves. You know, where it says, they were desirous that salvation should be declared unto every creature, for they could not bear that any human soul should perish. Yea, even the very thoughts that any soul should endure endless torment did cause them to quake and tremble. And thus did the Spirit of the Lord work upon them, for they were very vilest of sinners. And so there's this beautiful weaving of narratives where the converted children of Mosiah go to an even more extreme group, and then we have these powerful stories of conversions.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because I think that Ammon and Aaron, they're successful because they know what it is to experience this transition, this complete transformation from a state of unbelief to belief. And so they're able to speak to the power of such a transformation and also help midwife these people through that transformation because they took part in it themselves.
Great term. One of my mentors as an undergrad, I was so impressed by how much she helped me. And I basically said, you know, where do you get that energy? And she said, because I have them too. You know, and it's kind of that pay it forward. And it's our own experiences of events and experiences that have transformed us that make us want to expend the energy necessary to help others. It's a very beautiful virtuous cycle.
My other favorite part of this lesson, which is also a moment of transformation, is King Lamoni's father's agnostic prayer.
Yes.
Where he's looking for the transformation. He wants it. And so he offers up this prayer, right, where he's, if your God, if there is a God, and if it's you. And I really think that if at some point in our lives, if as an individual, we never reach a point in our life where we offer up a prayer like that, I think we've missed a really key part of the human experience, where we are set adrift here in this world, and there is so much we don't know. And so I think I find it deeply relatable and really beautiful.
I do too as well. And I think that we can use this story. We talk about I know so much in Mormon culture. And here we have a beautiful, empowering affirmation, basically saying it's okay to pray like this. You know, it's okay to have moments where we say, are you there, God? You know, like, God, is there a God? And are you there? And if there is a God, and whatever you are, I'm praying out to the universe or whatever. And I agree with you, Danielle, that these are powerful moments in our lives. And I hope that in our culture of I know, I know, I know, we can also embrace the power of I don't know, but I want to, and I'm trying.
I agree with you. I have some friends here in the area that are kind of struggling with the faith transition. And part of the issue that I've spoken quite openly with them is exactly the point to which you're addressing, is that culture of I know. And we see, like in chapter 19, verse 10, blessed art thou because of thy exceeding faith. You know, it's not exceeding knowledge. And unfortunately, within our culture, the idea of faith and belief takes second tier to knowledge, right? And it bothers me sometimes because there's certain things that I know, and then there's certain things that I believe, and there's certain things that I have faith in. And I think there's beauty in that faith. And I think there's beauty in that wrestling with God, you know, that we find in Genesis 32, that there's that intimacy as you pull him closer to you and you struggle with him. And hopefully you come out better at the end. But as Genesis 32 said, you know, Jacob, he hurt his hip afterwards, and it kind of reminded him of that struggle and that wrestle he had with God. And I think we need to be, as a community, we need to be more open to that idea of faith and belief and struggling with God and sometimes being angry with him, because there's been times when I've had that prayer. Are you there? Why aren't you answering me? I want something where I know that you're actually there. And so the point to which you two are both speaking for me is very personal. And it's something that I still wrestle with. I told my bishop after I'd been the young men's president for about a month, he brought me in for PEC. And I told him, you know, Mormonism, I wrestle with it. It hurts. And it's left me with a limp. And it's to remind me of that wrestle that I've had with God, with Mormonism, that I continue to have.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I think it's really powerful. Gwen or Paul?
You know, talking about that wrestle in coming out a better person, I think in chapter 17, verse 5, the brothers had much labor in the spirit. And I just wanted to bring that up as something that they came out on the other side of this labor in the spirit as better people.
In chapter 17, it talks about, and they knew that they had the curse upon them. I'm like, here you've got an idolatrous people, supposedly, that are making up their religion as they go, but they choose to keep the part that keeps them cursed. I found that very interesting.
It's bizarre. You know, Paul and I, our mother's Guatemalan and our dad's, you know, from the States. And growing up, my dad would call us his little Lamanites. We didn't think anything of it. We just thought, this is cool, right? We're different. We're a little bit browner than everybody else. And so for at least me, I can speak for Paul. But it was a source of pride. This whole racism, I'll just call it racism through the Book of Mormon, there's a couple ways I think you can go with it. And the one that I've decided to go with is that the Nephites were racist towards the Lamanites. And that's how I've justified it, as being, you know, kind of viewing the Book of Mormon as historical despite all its problems. And this is going to be a shameless plug for Paul's and my blog. But when I was working on my blog post for this lesson, I came across an interesting article in Life magazine during World War II. The title is pretty racist. The title is How to Tell a Jap from a Chinese. And it was in Life magazine. And it goes through this caricature of Japanese and Chinese, Japanese, of course, being our enemy at the time, and the Chinese supposedly are our ally. And they have a picture of a Chinese person, of a Japanese person with drawings on them showing how their faces are different and everything. And it struck me to be very parallel to how the Nephites saw the Lamanites, that the Lamanites were another. They were not us. They're somebody else. And so they felt very much justified in seeing them as a dark people that eat meat that's uncooked and run around half naked and shaved heads, you know. And so I don't take that as a literal curse, but as just the racism of the Nephites. And, you know, I could be completely wrong, but I don't see my brother and I as being necessarily cursed. Just really hairy, but not cursed.
Yeah, one interesting thing is it's really important to see who is saying what. So those verses are Mormon. This is a whole editorial insertion. But we do get the Lamanites' perspective. I think it's in Mosiah 9 or 10. And then something else where it's like, we were wronged. We are angry. We are wronged. You know, so we do get that perspective more than the cursed. That's one of the key approaches that I want to model in this class, is I feel like we let the scriptures off too easily. You know what I mean? That we're just like, oh, yes, let me slurp up this second Nephi, yum, yum. You know, and we don't wrestle, we don't challenge, we don't engage, and we don't say things like, hey, this is crazy. You know, where is this from? And I think we get a much more rich, not only a richer reading experience, but a better theology. So I do want to bring up, what about in chapter 19, I want to get your brief thoughts on this because I find it deeply problematic. When the brother of the leader that Ammon killed, when he goes to kill the unconscious Ammon and he's struck dead, God goes, eh, and strikes him dead. And how do we reconcile this with all the terrible, terrible things that happen? You know, why when the abuser is going toward the sleeping child, you know, why doesn't God go, eh? What do we do with this? I think it's a tough...
The thing with miracles, the problem with miracles, if you will, is you now have to justify it. You know, I think Mike and I were having this discussion earlier where if a child falls out of a two-story house and is alive, we call it a miracle of God. But if a kid falls off the counter and breaks his neck and dies, we're like, well, that's just God's plan. Where's the balance there?
And just Paul's quoting Christopher Hitchens for all those fans out there.
Nice. Way to bring Christopher Hitchens into Sunday school, Paul.
Yeah, he's dead, Paul. Nice job. So, No, it's deeply problematic. Yeah, and I don't have an answer for it. I think some people are more readily to see God's hand in everything, and then I think they're more trapped than someone who has a higher bar for calling something miracle, right? So some person will call like birth a miracle. I'm like, not really. I kind of know how it happens, you know.
Hey, I think birth is a miracle. It is a good point to comment that it is Mormon who's making a huge, huge, huge deal about this. I mean, let's say for the sake of argument that the moment that this guy, and I'm not trying to explain it away, I'm just exploring it a little bit. Let's say the moment the guy was about to kill him, he has like an aneurysm or something. But it's Mormon who makes all the links. It's Mormon who says, and this was a miracle, and this was God doing it, and this was in response to Mosiah's prayer. So, yeah, I mean, just...
I see your point. I agree with you. It's Mormon being an editor again, right? He keeps to the history, but then he uses the history to teach his theology that he wants to bring about.
And I think it's a potentially problematic theology, but at the same time, to dig into the text a little bit, we should see that even if, you know, this guy died on the spot, it's Mormon who's making an explicit statement. Really appreciate the conversation. Hope we can continue it on the blog. Any closing comments or thoughts before we finish up?
When you come to know the Lamanites, they have a king, they have flocks, they've built cities. This is not a ferocious people. It's not a, you know, bloodthirsty, murderous. If you go into a society and everyone's bloodthirsty, the society's just not going to work. And so this analogy he has, you can say, okay, Mormon's just racist, and he sets that up as these crazy people, and they go in there and they're like, oh, they have cities and flocks and all this other sort of thing. It just doesn't work there.
Or it's like, maybe we're all human and flawed and fallible and God works with it.
We have these ideas that these two groups of Lamanites and Nephites have these preconceived notions of how horrible one another are. And love, I'm going to say it again, I'm going to say it every time I can, through love, these stereotypes are just squashed, and there's a richness and this beauty and this friendship that develops, and they learn to love one another. And that's the greatest thing we can learn, is how to love one another.
I think that's really beautiful. And I think that we see even more critically that even though it matters to them who's who and who belongs where, it clearly does not to God. God was willing to visit some event upon a bish that converted her to the gospel of Christ. And God was willing to provide a testimony to all of the Lamanites that the brothers of Mosiah were preaching to, because God cares not at all for these divisions that we put up amongst ourselves. And I think obviously God's view of us is the ultimate example and the one that we should cultivate, right? We shouldn't see these false divisions we place between ourselves about who's from where, who's what gender, and who has what job or what position in society. Because God will visit all of us equally if given the opportunity.
Thank you. That is a great note to end on. And I really, once again, like how the threads fit together, how the once you are converted... Enos's prayer is the same thing, just to point to that really quick, where when we are converted, we have this desire and energy to transcend our limitations and transcend our perspectives and reach across the barriers to engage with those not like us and those different, and those lines between us and them disappear. And that's a really beautiful message. So thank you for being part of our first Engaging Gospel Doctrine class discussion. It was great. And for all you listeners out there, glad that you were part of this. And we will see you next lesson.
Thanks, Jared.
Thanks.
Thank you.